Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage's completely online process lets you get a custom mortgage solution wherever and whenever you want. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. American innovation transformed the world. Electric light, human flight, on and on. Lately, the talk is of an innovation slump. Is it real? Even with all the AI and gene therapies and robotics and machines thinking out there? And if so, why? This hour On Point, what's up with American innovation? You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Are we all tapped out? Will we be amazed in the next decade or two? Do we still have the right stuff at work for big innovation? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me first today from Washington is Greg Ipp. He's chief economics commentator at the Wall Street Journal. Greg, welcome back to On Point.
Good to talk to you, Tom.
You say it looks like we're in a golden age of innovation, but there's a problem with what we think we're seeing. What's going on, Greg?
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, the headlines are full of stories about artificial intelligence, driverless cars, gene therapy, and so on. But if you actually look at the hard data, it's really hard to identify the impact, the benefits of all this innovation. The broadest measure we have of innovation is in something we call multi-factor productivity. And all you need to know is that that measure of growth has been declining since the 1950s. For the last decade, it was around 0.5%, which is one of the slowest we've ever recorded. But even if we look at other sort of metrics, for example, human life, we sort of see the same thing. Last year was the first time since 1993 that U.S. life expectancy declined. How can that be when we're having all these breakthroughs with drugs and so forth? Well, a lot of the drugs that we're discovering only address rare diseases. The big killers, the childhood killers, were cured or treated many years ago, and the treatments we have now just don't address the big killers that are left behind. Even when you look at personal technology, nobody disputes that the iPhone is a great product and has all sorts of wonderful things for us to do. But that phone came out in 2007. Everything since then has been incremental. The broader picture, Tom, when you step back, is that there is a lot of exciting stuff going on, but it doesn't really seem to be moving the needle in terms of our standard of living.
I mean, people may look at that declining life expectancy and say we have social issues there. Let's set that aside for a second, though. How far can you set that aside? But you look at this total factor productivity, say it reached 3.4% a year in the 1950s, and in the current decade, it's about a half of 1%. And this is where innovation meets the workforce. That's what drives this measure.
Well, essentially, you can advance our standard of living by having more workers to produce stuff, equipping those workers with more equipment, what we call capital, or combining the workers and the capital more creatively, sort of with more techniques and more innovation. That's what we call the multi-factor productivity. What it basically means is that at a certain point, you can't just keep giving workers more of the same equipment because the law of diminishing returns sets in. There has to be a new, different kind of equipment, or they have to be managed more effectively some way. It's that missing ingredient, the creativity, that's dragging down productivity growth.
You carve out personal technology, but you say if you look beyond that, look around, and improvements in our everyday life have been, you say, incremental, not revolutionary. Houses, appliances, cars look much like they did a generation ago. Airplanes fly no faster than in the 1960s. None, you write in a recent piece, none of the 20 most prescribed drugs in the U.S. came to market in the past decade. What's going on?
Well, I think there's a couple of things going on. I think the hurdles for transforming ideas into truly broad-based breakthroughs have just gotten higher. And this, Tom, is the key. It's not the it's not the absence of ideas, because we have lots of ideas. It's the impact of those ideas and the breadth in terms of the number of people whose lives are affected. It looks like some of the low-hanging fruit in science, medicine, technology has been harvested. You can't invent antibiotics a second time, just for one example.
Though we need some new ones.
That is absolutely true. And we can talk about that a little bit later, how some of our prior innovations are now sort of failing us. I also think that at a certain level, society has become more risk-averse, and appropriately so. As societies become richer and more affluent, we treasure human life more. And we don't want entrepreneurs and risk-takers to take chances with their with the population at large when they're trying out a new device or something like that. So we appropriately have more regulation in place. That, however, does have a cost, which is that it raises the cost of experimentation and so forth. And it may be in some areas that that is slowing down the pace of innovation.
I mean, maybe there's a valuable learning curve in that. Some of the big innovations in the last couple hundred years ended up, yes, they brought us many things, fine steel and all the rest, but they also brought an awful lot of pollution. They brought a lot of, now we're looking at climate change. I mean, maybe there's some greater caution generally with the idea of just throwing big ideas out there and seeing where they take us, Greg.
Well, exactly. And I think that one of the things we have to understand is that a lot of the innovation going into our labs right now is aimed at, in some sense, fixing some of the problems that were left behind from innovation in the past. And I would say the environment is a prime example. We've been burning fossil fuels now for a couple of centuries, and we could go on and on and on about all the benefits that has brought, from central heating to cheap electricity to the automobile. But we also know that it has had a lot of negative impacts on the environment, from particles in the air to ozone, and now, of course, global warming. We're going to spend a lot of money fixing that problem, and fixing that problem will not necessarily raise GDP. It will make us better off, but it's not going to show up in our productivity data.
But fixing up problems, whether it's pollution or whether it's we produce so much food now that we've got obesity problems.
Exactly. Yeah.
It seems like that ought to be captured as a net positive somehow.
It isn't. In fact, one of the big debates raging over the whole innovation question nowadays is whether we're actually properly measuring the benefits of our innovation. For example, a lot of the great things you get on your iPhone or on your computer, you don't pay for. I use Google Search several times a day. Never paid a penny for that. I can use my iPhone now as a GPS device that gets me from point A to point B with all sorts of accuracy and information in between. I don't pay for that. So isn't it possible that we are getting huge benefits in our lives? We're just not seeing it in numbers that we have to pay for, and therefore it's not showing up in GDP. There might be some truth to that, but I would respond, and some other scholars would respond, that that has always been the case, that most of the benefits of innovation did not show up in GDP. For example, all the lives saved from childhood vaccines, the children, the people who are walking around because we essentially wiped out smallpox many decades ago. Bob Gordon, in his book, The Rise and Fall of American Growth, has a terrific section dealing with all the negatives associated with horse travel, you know, being killed by a kick of a horse or thrown from a horse's back, the injuries from that, you know, the flies and the manure that would pile high in the streets and so forth. The internal combustion engine and the car got rid of all those problems, and those benefits never showed up in GDP.
But you stand by the assertion that the U.S. is now in an innovation slump?
I do. Now, that is not the same as saying that we will not have new ideas again or another big idea. I absolutely believe that we are having many new ideas all the time and that there will be breakthroughs. But it does really look to me that there are forces at work that means that those breakthroughs will be fewer and farther between, and that we need to put more resources, whether it's government R&D money or whether it's more brains, more like people studying science and technology, to produce the same number of breakthroughs as in the past and keep us moving forward.
More resources. A lot of resources, of course, gathered in Silicon Valley. Greg, please stand by there in Washington. I want to turn to one of your colleagues, Jack Nickas. He's a staff reporter for the Wall Street Journal, covers technology in Silicon Valley. We saw a lot of the big heads of Silicon Valley firms meeting in Trump Tower with Donald Trump last week. And Jack has been covering, the innovation front there. He's with us from San Francisco. Jack Nickas, thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Your colleague Greg Ipp says there's an innovation slump in this country. Silicon Valley is supposed to be our antidote to that. Does Silicon Valley buy the innovation slump characterization of the U.S. economy?
I would say not. I think that Silicon Valley certainly has been the source of tremendous innovation and growth in the world of software over the past two decades or so, and that has had a big impact on our lives, you know, in the world of the internet. You mentioned Google Search, email, smartphones, et cetera. I did write a story for this series, though, that looks at Silicon Valley pushing out of software and into the physical world, and they're finding that the physical world is far harder to control than the digital turf that they're very familiar with.
I mean, Peter Thiel, a billionaire co-founder of PayPal, who's been become an advisor, Republicans, become an advisor to Donald Trump and was there at this meeting at Trump Tower with the heads of so many companies. Here he was talking kind of on this front where you say they're moving now, but this is in 2014, talking with Channel 4 in the UK, Channel 4 News, saying, hey, we've proven ourselves pretty good at bits, but not so good at the material world, transformations in the material world. Here's Thiel.
It has transformed them in the world of bits. So I do think there's been enormous progress in computers, internet, mobile internet. But we've been in an era of relative stagnation in the world of atoms. There's not been that much innovation on energy or transportation, or for that matter, space travel or underwater cities or, you know, flying cars.
Underwater cities and flying cars. Silicon Valley is looking to the material, to the atoms, not just the bits. But it's a little rougher going than software, Jack?
You got it. This is a very real trend in the Valley here, and I think, you know, many venture capitalists like Peter Thiel, many big technology executives like the Larry Page, who's the CEO of Google parent Alphabet, talk about this shift from bits to atoms. And, you know, Google alone, you can look at what they're doing. They're trying to develop self-driving cars, new contact lenses, interactive clothing, you know, delivery drones, et cetera. And, you know, all of these are obviously quite ambitious ideas, but they are taking much longer to come to fruition than, say, Google Search did. We must be reminded that, you know, Larry Page and Sergey Brin started Google Search on a single computer at Stanford University in 1996, and by 2000, that service handled 60 million queries a day. Yet, something like delivery drones, which I detail in my story, they started this in 2012, and today, 4 years later, they are hardly that much closer to doing this in the real world.
And if they, even if they succeeded, given the difficulties they've had, would that be on the order of, you know, innovations, breakthroughs in electricity, in aviation, in antibiotics? Are we talking the same scale here, Jack?
Well, I think that's a fair question. I mean, I know, you know, the advent of electricity or the airplane is going to be tough to match. However, I think there is an argument to be made, you know, and some of these folks in Silicon Valley would argue that, you know, something like delivery drones could transform logistics in many ways, at least that last mile, which has been so cumbersome for shipping companies. But we also have to think of self-driving cars. That could be a tremendous advance in productivity and by freeing people up from driving, et cetera. But again, I think the point we want to stress here is that while they are pushing potentially big innovations, the job of doing this is going to be much harder, and they're finding that with many struggles.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about American innovation. If it's still got the pop, the capacity for breakthroughs to shake things up, transform the way we live. Greg Ipp and Jack Nickus are with us from the Wall Street Journal. They've been looking at this in a series there. Greg is the chief economics commentator. Jack Nickus covers technology in Silicon Valley. We're going to go to China in just a moment, where they are pouring resources into a push for big innovation. You can join us as well. Do we, Americans, still have the juice, the capacity to change the world with innovation? Are we dreaming big? Are you dreaming big in your arena? Do we have the education, the freedom, the structures to produce, create the next big thing, the next electricity, the next flight? Here was Jeff Bezos, CEO of Amazon. This is back a couple of years back, talking about the kind of company that he wants Amazon to be or evolve into being.
I would define Amazon by our big ideas, which are customer centricity, putting the customer at the center of everything we do, invention. We like to pioneer. We like to explore. We like to go down dark alleys and see what's on the other side.
Into drones and more, but that's not as easily said, done as said when you get into the material world. Jack Nickus is reporting out of Silicon Valley. We had this big meeting in Trump Tower with a dozen or so Silicon Valley CEOs and President-elect Donald Trump. This was last week, and you had Bezos was there, Apple CEO Tim Cook, Tesla CEO Elon Musk, and more. Here was Donald Trump at that meeting.
We want you to keep going with the incredible innovation. There's nobody like you in the world. There's nobody like the people in this room. And anything we can do to help this go along, and we're going to be there for you. And you'll call my people, you'll call me. It doesn't make any difference. We have no formal chain of command around here.
Call my people, call me. The president-elect saying, hey, wide open to you guys. So they had been some pretty tough critics of him during the campaign. I mean, I want to ask about resources that are going into this. Greg Gipp, are we putting enough resources into the kind of R&D that lead to big innovation? I'm looking at a piece here in your paper by the president of MIT, Raphael Reif, recently saying no, saying that we put 2% of GDP into R&D back, the federal government did, back in the 1970s. Now it's under 1%, 0.78, just not enough. And he says that private industry is all about the too much about the D and not fundamental about development of products, not really about fundamental science and deep research. What about the resources we're putting in this direction, Greg?
Well, it's an interesting picture that you raise here, because if you actually look at the raw numbers, we're putting a lot of resources. It's true that the government contribution to R&D has declined since the 60s and 70s, but the private contribution has gone up. And as a result, total national resources that go into R&D is very close to the peaks that it hit in the 60s and the 70s.
But is the MIT chief right that it's about D? It's about developing products rather than the
exactly.
deep science.
So that's exactly right. So there is less resources going into the pure research that doesn't necessarily have a commercial endpoint. So there's a very strong case to be made that we need to be doing more of that. We have a lot of people employed in science and technology and engineering and math, these so-called STEM occupations. Data that's been compiled by the National Science Foundation shows that science and engineering workers, the share of our workforce, are basically at an all-time high. But if you go back to one of the original points that our articles were making, is that it appears that you need more effort just to produce the same breakthrough. So it doesn't really matter what these numbers tell us. We know that they need to be higher to get the same yield. Now, you brought up the meeting between Trump and Silicon Valley, and the president-elect was appropriately saying that these people are the most innovative and energetic business leaders in the United States. We need more of that innovative effort. But then we'll have to turn to what agenda the president-elect has that sort of help them forward. Now, Mr. Trump has put a lot of emphasis on job creation. He wants these companies to bring jobs back to the United States. Their response would be, well, it's really hard to build the iPhone as cheaply in the United States as it is in China and East Asia, which has this enormous chain of source companies. And if the price of an iPhone becomes quite a bit more to make in the United States, then fewer people are going to be making software apps, and we'll lose out on that innovation. Meanwhile, one of the priorities of Silicon Valley is more immigration. Let's bring more of those bright young scientists and engineers and creative and dynamic entrepreneurial types that are now working in very poor countries around the world. Let's bring them to the United States and feed this amazing job creation engine. But we know that the president-elect campaigned on a policy of much stricter immigration. So those are some of the flashpoints that are going to have to be resolved.
Jack Nickas, you covered that meeting occurred at Trump Tower. Is Silicon Valley now optimistic about this presidency? I mean, it seems to me that a lot of the innovation we're hearing out of Silicon Valley could cost jobs. In robotics, you talk self-driving cars, there go a lot of Uber drivers and maybe truck drivers right there. Are the goals of the Trump administration in Silicon Valley aligning, Jack?
Well, I would say that Silicon Valley executives here are wary of President-elect Donald Trump. Certainly, there were few executives or folks in general in Silicon Valley who were supporters of Mr. Trump. And in reality, at this point now, dealing with the new reality, they are essentially hoping to maintain the status quo. They've had an era of tremendous growth under the Obama administration. Now, in terms of this potential clash between the priorities of the Trump administration to push for job creation, there is a potential to put Silicon Valley on the defensive, because while these companies do employ hundreds of thousands of people, their great reliance on software means that they actually, while they are some of the biggest, most valuable companies in the world, they actually employ fewer people per company than many other similar-sized firms. And therefore, they could get some unwanted attention from the Trump administration for that reason.
What about Silicon Valley itself as the, if that's what we can call it, cauldron for U.S. innovation? Is it the right place for that, Jack? You've got such a concentration there now of capital and resources and some kind of monopoly dynamics that kick in when you get a deep first mover advantage in some of these industries. Is it
does it end up sitting on other potential innovators in this country because so much power and wealth is right there?
Well, certainly you're right about the concentration of power and money here. They have had an enormous amount of influence and success over the past several years. I think what we will see, we are seeing them as the spearhead for innovation in many ways because of the money they have. They are willing to take the risk and they have the resources to try to do it. But, you know, as my story pointed out, they're not having as much success in the physical world as they have had in software. And some argue that maybe it's the traditional companies that produce airplanes produce certain hardware goods that are better positioned to make innovations in those worlds versus a company that has traditionally always made a software product suddenly try to make a better contact lens, for example. So this will be a question going forward whether some of these companies like Google and Facebook and Amazon are going to be able to fan out and innovate across many different industries that they aren't necessarily experts in.
Jack Nickus in San Francisco. We're going to hop to China. Thank you very much for being with us for a few minutes here today. Greg Epstein by Eva Dou joins us right now from Beijing, another reporter at the Wall Street Journal. They've really been looking at this innovation question and caught our attention. Headline on her big piece, Eastern Revival, after a 1,000-year slumber, China vows to invent again, and they're pouring resources into that. Eva Dou in Beijing, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on the show.
What's the scale of China's push for greater innovation to sort of get on that frontier and own part of it? How big is it? Where are they aiming?
It is a huge push. It is it's one of the country's top goals right now, and resources on a national level are going towards this push. There is kind of this sense of manifest destiny right now in China, in that like the long arc of history is finally swinging back. In China, this question of innovation is taking place on a time frame of more than a millennium, in that the last time China was the world leader in innovation was in the Middle Ages. China's four great inventions, paper, the printing press, gunpowder, the compass, those all were invented more than a millennium ago. And since then, China has been a steady decline and falling behind the West. And so so finally, there's this sense in China that they're catching up again to the point where they can really make a push towards the front of innovation.
You remind us that their reputation and the fact has been that they've been what's called a fast follower, copying foreign innovations rather than inventing their own. If they're pouring, and you say they are pouring billions now into moonshot projects, what are some of China's big targets, Eva?
Yeah, so there has been this sense in China that innovation is something that takes huge amount of resources and money, and you do have to be targeted at it. So China's strategy in most sectors has been a fast follower, globalization rather than innovation, just copying what the West has done and not reinventing the wheel, which indeed is a much cheaper way about it. And so right now, they're targeting very specialized sectors where they feel they can pass on the curve. And so some of those include quantum research and supercomputers. These are two sectors that around the world are very much developing sectors, and China's pouring billions of dollars into it and in the hopes of catching up or even beating the West to it.
In June, their most powerful computer, supercomputer, topped one ranking anyway of the world's fastest computers, the Sunway Taihu Light, five times as fast as America's top supercomputer by that reckoning. They've got a quantum communications satellite, you report, that potentially puts the country in a lead position to develop hack-proof communications. That sounds pretty useful these days. What else are they aiming at with quantum mechanics and big computing power?
Yeah, well, there are a lot of national security applications for these kinds of technologies. Increasingly, wars are taking place in cyberspace, in addition to the battlefield. And so, so areas like encryption and being able to communicate safely and be able to crunch massive amounts of data these are areas that China and all other countries feel are important, not only to their economy, but to national security. So many areas of computing like this is where China is targeting.
How ambitious are they? You report that there's a push on teleportation. It sounds like Star Trek. Is that a serious push in China, teleportation?
Yeah. It sounds like something that's only in science fiction, but actually, and it's crazy, like quantum physicists can actually teleport photons now. Like they can make a speck of light disappear from one place and reappear somewhere else. And this is, of course, very high-tech and very expensive research, which is the main reason that China has been the first country to put a quantum satellite into space to begin this kind of experiment. It's mainly that they're the first country to put this much resources into it and hiring some of the top researchers to work on it, and basically giving them a blank check to do whatever it takes to do this research.
Is it novelty stuff, Eva, or is there a sense that they could round the U.S. and sort of come out with unveiling a whole new realm of innovation where we just wouldn't be a player?
Well, they're working on very targeted things like quantum communications, semiconductors, supercomputers. But throughout history for innovation, throughout history, when countries have put a lot of resources on trying to push forward research in a field, a lot of times innovations come out as side effects that aren't expected. And so this is maybe something we can expect from China, in that a lot of times when you do this research, unexpected things come out of it. Like the internet, for instance, was more a side effect of other research that was done for more military purposes at the beginning.
In the U.S., pour in the resources and you never know what's going to come out. Maybe come out the side. Eva Doe, reporter with the Wall Street Journal in Beijing. Great to have you with us today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Greg Ipp, stand by. Eric Bjornolfsson at MIT joins us in just a moment. Callers, though, Andrea in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Andrea, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to contribute to this conversation because I actually know something about it. I have usually people, young scientists who work at MGH in their labs living in my home.
You're talking the Massachusetts General Hospital. All right.
Yes, Massachusetts General Hospital. And MGH recruits worldwide for these young scientists. One that I had living in my home for 2 years, I'm taking him as an example, is a biomedical engineer, which means he knows both medicine and engineering. He builds things that go in, say, for example, inside your heart to measure what's happening there. Okay, he's so successful at that he was recruited by a for-profit firm to set up his own lab outside Boston. He's Italian. He's now setting up his own lab, and he's the person who decides who works there.
How do you judge whether it's world-scale innovation, Andrea, or a sort of micro-advance within medical science?
Well, worldwide, in that they recruit people worldwide. Worldwide in that what is invented is produced and distributed worldwide.
Yeah, no question. We've got products being developed and products going out. I mean, Greg Ipp, this is what people do, right? I mean, we've got a lot of labs in this country. People are hard at work every day. Andrea says, what innovation crisis? I see all these people doing stuff every day.
Well, right. And I think that we are, in fact, seeing significant improvements in specific areas of mortality in the healthcare area. But I guess I would go back to one of the original points that we make in our series, which is just how broad are the implications of some of these breakthroughs. I'll give you one example, Tom, and that's gene therapy, which has been an area of excitement for several decades now. We sequenced the human genome over a decade ago. To date, there's only one commercially available gene therapy in Western Europe or the United States. It's called called Glybera. It's available in Europe. It costs $1 million per dose. It addresses an extremely rare condition that only a few hundred people in Europe have. Now, you compare that, for example, to antibiotics. By the late 1940s, you could get a course of penicillin for $10. That's in today's money.
Mm-hmm.
And the availability of penicillin and all the other antibiotic drugs that followed quickly after it just transformed medical care and saved hundreds of millions of lives. I'm not saying that there isn't a potential for other breakthroughs, such as the young recruits that the caller talked about, coming up with something similar. But it does seem that the hurdles are higher and fewer further between.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings home financing into the 21st century with a completely online process that's fast, easy, and convenient. Using a phone or tablet, you can safely share bank statements and pay stubs without having to dig through piles of paperwork. It takes just a few minutes to get a custom mortgage solution on your terms, wherever and whenever you want. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSConsumerAccess.org number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about American innovation. If it's still got the pop, the capacity for breakthroughs to shake things up, transform the way we live. Greg Ipp has been looking at it for the Wall Street Journal. He's chief economics commentator there, joins us today from Washington. You can join us as well. Are we lagging? What's holding us back? Are we forging ahead? Are we ready to bust out, go big? How do you see American innovation right now? In October, President Obama talked about innovation during the White House Frontiers Conference in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
We're seeing science and technology spur new jobs and new industries, new discoveries that are improving our lives, and in many cases, saving lives. And that's consistent with this nation, who we are, a nation born from an idea that became the world's laboratory.
An idea that became the world's laboratory. Are we still? Will we be? We heard the report from China there, billions being poured into some very out there stuff. Of course, there's a lot going on in this country as well. How do you see the net balance of American innovation right now? Let's get a call from Boston. Robert is calling. Hi, Robert. You're on the air. What's on your mind? What do you see?
Hi, Tom. I see a big problem with something called technology readiness levels, which is used by government agencies to evaluate innovation. I have a company called Tubular Rail, which is in the transportation field. And when we've responded to requests for information or whatnot through transit agencies, State Department of Transportation of agencies, when they evaluate a project, they borrow something called technology readiness levels, which was developed by NASA and the Defense Department to eliminate risk. NASA would not get any credit for putting a man in orbit and not being able to bring him back. So the technology they wanted was the most cautious and risk-averse. What we need with innovation is a government attitude, especially in these transportation projects, that look at innovation and say, what would it take to move this idea to the next level?
Robert, let us pick it up right there, because, Greg, this is something you point to, concern about risk aversion in American culture right now. And there is an innovator, it sounds to me, who feels like he's running up against sort of government hurdles, guardrails that make it tougher to forge ahead.
Yeah, Tom, I think the caller raises a very good point. And just in the headlines a few days ago, we learned that Uber had launched a driverless taxi pilot project in San Francisco. And then when somebody videotaped one of these taxis going through a red light, the California Department of Motor Vehicles issued a cease and desist order. And I guess the two sides are going to end up in court over that. Now, this raises an interesting question. If you're a pedestrian in San Francisco, you don't want driverless taxis going through red lights.
No, you don't.
It's quite appropriate that the government would step in. But on the other hand, somebody might say, well, has there ever been an advance of some kind that didn't somewhere along the line hurt somebody? Earlier this year, a guy in Ohio was killed when he was driving his Tesla in autonomous mode.
Yep.
And it hit a tractor trailer that the computer on the car did not recognize as a vehicle, and he was killed. One might say that's a tragedy. On the other hand, it gives lessons and information that makes the next generation of driverless cars better and safer. The first jet airliner was the de Havilland Comet. It crashed, I think, 5 times, killing a lot of people before they figured out that there was a structural flaw in how they had built that. We would never allow that experience to repeat itself nowadays. When Boeing brought out the de Havilland Dreamliner, the 787, probably the most advanced commercial airliner today, it had already flown thousands of times in test mode, like in everything from searing desert heat to frozen Arctic temperatures. And then it developed this problem with battery fires. That happened several times before the entire fleet was grounded around the world. Again, I fly. I don't want to fly on an airplane where the battery might catch fire. So I, on the one hand, appreciate this. But at a social level, you have to ask the question, are we so cautious that we've actually raised the bar so that people like the caller are not incentivized to go out and produce new things that might actually, in the end, save more lives? If we go back to the example of driverless cars, there are people right now, disabled people, elderly people, who are basically housebound, reliant on things like public transit or relatives because they can no longer drive. Driverless cars offer enormous potential to transform their lives. And it may be that if we are too cautious in the present, we're giving up enormous benefits to health and human happiness in the future.
Attention built in right there. But on the other hand, if the plane's going to explode in flames, I don't want it on my flight. You don't want it on yours.
No way.
Another right here, Ezra in Newton, Massachusetts. Ezra, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm a scientist who works in biotechnology, and I believe the innovations coming down the line are going to be earth-shattering. We are going to eliminate birth defects largely with CRISPR. Blindness will become a thing of the past. But even beyond that, if you look at the really big problems in our world, most of them are due to either mental illness or our failure to understand one another. War, the acrimony over the recent election, we don't understand one another. If we can actually innovate and help people understand one another and reduce the level of war in the world, these things are earth-shattering.
Is science going to do that, Ezra? Biotech?
I believe it will. We know so little about the human brain, it's scary.
And in CRISPR, you're talking about gene editing there, and certainly there's enormous potential there. Robert, I appreciate you, Ezra, I appreciate your call. Greg, you have to stand by. I want to bring Eric Brynjolfsson into our conversation. He's with us via Skype from Brandon, England today, professor of information technology at MIT. He looks at the effects of information tech on productivity, the economy, co-author of The Second Machine Age, Work, Progress, and Prosperity in a Time of Brilliant Technologies. Eric Brynjolfsson, thanks very much for being with us today.
Good to be with you.
The Wall Street Journal is very focused on the economy, and they've got this big series out talking about an innovation slump and kind of ringing some alarm bells here. What do you think of it, Eric?
Well, it's a great story, and I'm glad you have focusing on this. And I agree with much of what your guest has said, but I think my views are much closer to Ezra's and Andrea's and President Obama's. I think a lot of cause for mindful optimism. Not only are there these breakthroughs in biotech that we just heard about, but I think we're in the early stages of really the biggest breakthrough in human history, which is the rise of machine intelligence. I think future generations will look back and think at marvel at, you know, that we were in the period, maybe about a 10 or 15 year period, where machines started learning how to talk to us and listen to us and answer our questions. Right now they're a little clumsy, but you can see it happening. They're learning how to see. The Cambrian explosion was a key milestone in biological history when biological organisms learned how to see. Now machines are learning how to do it. They're learning how to think and answer questions, diagnose cancer, or as you talked about, driving cars. It's hard for me to think of anything bigger than that, and we're right in the midst of it.
When's it going to show up, Eric? When's it going to change the kind of numbers that Greg Ipp is looking at, where he's got this total factor productivity way down from the 1950s? When does machine intelligence turn that around for the U.S. economy, maybe the world?
I think we're going to see more and more of it in the next 10 years. I think some of it's going to start showing up soon. As Greg mentioned, some of it isn't going to be in the GDP statistics, but it's going to lift our living standards. You rightly pointed out that the improvements in, whether it's in pollution, cleaner air, lifespans, or just all the free goods we have, they don't show up in GDP. So we're going to miss some of it in the way we count the statistics so far, but it's still going to make us better off.
Greg Ipp, are you guys blind to this onslaught, this incoming tide of machine intelligence? Eric says it's going to transform everything.
I don't think I'm blind to it. And if I am blind, I hope gene therapy will correct that blindness before too long. But,
CRISPR, look, come to me.
Eric and I have actually talked about this. I'm a huge admirer of his work and his book. And I don't think there's a big difference between what we're saying. I think to a great extent, he's looking forward and I'm looking backward. I'm saying, we've had all these innovations to date. Where's the proof that they've benefited us? And I think Eric is saying, just wait. And I think Eric has also in the past made a very good point, which I'm going to repeat here to our listeners, which is that historically we know that there are often long legs between an innovative, when a family of innovations comes out and when they transform the world. The electric light bulb was commercialized, I think, around 1879. It was probably 30 or 40 years before electricity began to really impact the national productivity and growth statistics. And it may be that what Eric is talking about is a similar episode, that these transformations in artificial intelligence are going to hit us like a tidal wave 10 or 15 years from now. I think the word of caution I would bring forth is that we've heard these types of things talked about other innovations in the past, whether it's gene therapy or superconductors or nanotechnology, and those did not end up transforming lives because it turned out that the commercialization or the physical barriers were just insurmountable. What I think both the optimists and the pessimists, and those of us who are in between, and I would count myself one of those, need to have is humility, which is that the fundamental characteristic of innovation is just how unpredictable it is. I mean, Eric can probably remember this better, but I think the inventor of the supercomputer once said that the world would never need more than five of them or something like that.
Right, that was the mainframe computer, right?
That's right. And so it's very difficult to know beforehand just how the creative minds and the entrepreneurs are going to figure out how to take an innovation that is made it much cheaper to do something that you couldn't do before and run with it. We were talking about drones earlier. Maybe if we were able to bring the cost of drone delivery down dramatically, it would rival the jet airplane in terms of the transformations it could bring to us. So I think that if we're trying to think about how to help this process along, I say that we should be agnostic about what technologies are really going to be the breakthroughs and just try and approach the whole question of innovation with a bit more permission, a bit more embrace of risk and so forth. And I'll give you the examples of drones. Until last year, it was basically illegal in the United States to have a commercial drone delivery system. The FAA simply did not have a rule framework that allowed it. Now, at Congress's urging, they do have one. But it's still sort of like very, very cautious. A drone cannot travel out of the line of sight of an operator. It cannot fly over several hundred feet in terms of altitude. The priority here being to avoid collisions with manned aircraft. Once again, a very important goal. I don't want to be on an airplane that collides with a drone. But it may be possible. It may be that the regulators are being overly cautious here and making it harder for the likes of Amazon and Google to experiment enough to figure out how to make drones really useful.
But Greg, even if they work that out, is that really on the scale of electricity, aviation, antibiotics, drone delivery of the shoes I ordered?
So, Tom, here I'm going to flip around a little bit and actually take the optimistic side, which is to say it might be. That's the whole thing, right? I just don't know. I mean, I would not have guessed that that clunky BlackBerry we started out with in the early 1990s would now be this iPhone that I can now order an Uber car off of, like at the press of a button.
Eric, let me put it to you. You say machine intelligence is going to just blow us away a scale of innovations in the deployment of electricity, of human flight, of antibiotics, and all that those meant. Is it?
I think arguably bigger. It's honestly hard for me to think of anything bigger that's going to happen to humanity, and we're in the midst of it. Let me just underscore what Greg said. The past stats are a very bad predictor of future growth, so I don't think we should be at all pessimistic that we've had a few bad years. I think you have to look at what the technologies can do, and if they can start innovating themselves, then we have an almost unbounded number of innovators working on this. We already have billions of people connected to the internet. But ultimately, I think there's been a metaphor going on in your show since the beginning that I want to challenge.
Good.
That's this idea of low-hanging fruit, that we're kind of using up the innovations. I don't think that's the right way to think about most innovations. A better metaphor is building blocks. That every time we invent something, we make it easier to invent other things. The reason we have the internet is because someone else invented electricity. And people are building on top of that. We have more 25-year-old billionaires than I think we've ever had. And they haven't spent, 70 years mining some obscure corner. They're taking a bunch of building blocks that already existed, reconfiguring them in a new way, and creating vast, vast wealth, not just for themselves, but for all of us.
Well, yeah, we've seen a concentration there. Okay, what about resource or structural impediments? Do you see any problem with this machine intelligence revolution actually rolling out? Will it roll out through American minds in the American economy, and do we have resource or structural issues?
I see two big challenges. The first one is the one that Greg and a number of you have talked about, which is that we're really doing a bad job of translating these technological breakthroughs into things that help real people. And that requires organizational change. Electricity required reinventing of factories, requires new skills. We're lagging terribly in that. And I think we're getting worse at it, actually. There's less innovation in business models, fewer startups, more sclerosis in the economy overall. And we got to work on that part. I think that's the real bottleneck, not the lack of technological innovations. The second one is one that you just alluded to, which is the growing inequality. There's just no economic law that says that everyone's going to benefit from these breakthroughs. It's quite possible for the benefits to flow to just a very, very small, less than 1% of the people. We have to actively take charge of that challenge as well.
What does that mean, Eric? What does that mean? I mean, electricity ended up working pretty much for everybody in a big, big way. If that's not the case of the next wave, what's it mean to actively take charge of that dynamic?
Well, I think it wasn't just automatic. If you look back at the earlier eras, there was the invention of mass public education, of Social Security, of all sorts of changes in progressive income taxes, antitrust laws. We had radically transformed our institutions and our organizations to help ensure shared prosperity. If we don't do that this time, similarly reinventing education, changing our tax structure, changing the way that businesses are regulated, we could easily have a growing concentration. But it's far from inevitable. I would see this as a choice that we have before us.
Is it going to be us out there, out front, Eric, or China?
You know, I'm a little hesitant to make this into a nationalistic us versus them. I think most of the time it's great when India or China or Singapore or Britain or anybody else makes breakthroughs. If they can cure a disease, if they can develop safer self-driving cars, most of the time that benefits all of us, just like it benefits them.
China was poor for centuries when it wasn't out front. We don't want to be behind, do we?
No, but one of the reasons China is becoming richer is because they've been sharing and learning from our technologies, and we're becoming a much more globally connected world where ideas spread quite rapidly. And an inventor, wherever they are in the world, is likely to lift living standards across the globe.
Greg, how do we square Eric's optimism, his mindful optimism, with your warnings?
Well, not to try and sound like I'm making friends with Eric here, but I actually do agree with a lot of the points that he made. If I agree that I have a somewhat pessimistic view of where things are, but I don't think that's an excuse to basically give up. And I actually agree with a lot of Eric's emphasis on education, on openness, on addressing issues like inequality, because, again, it may be that he's right and a huge innovation is just around the corner. I want us to be ready for it and have all the resources in place that can exploit it.
We're not into giving up here, so we'll go with that. Eric, what do you say?
I think regardless of whether you are pessimistic or optimistic, the prescriptions are kind of the same, which is we have to reinvent education. We need to make it easier for those innovations to get into the pipeline. So I think Greg and I are ending the show on a common note.
Okay, I'm heartened, cautiously, mindfully heartened. Eric Brynjolfsson, author of The Second Machine Age, co-author there. Thank you very much for being with us today, Eric.
Always a pleasure.
And Greg Ipp at the Wall Street Journal, chief economics commentator there. Thanks for coming on today, Greg.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Listeners, thanks for all your input. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.